purity, purity, purity. All persons having business before this honorable court are reminded to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Evans from Milwaukee. I'm pleased to be joined today by Judge Ann Williams from Chicago and our newest member of the Court of Appeals, Judge Diane Sykes from Milwaukee. Actually, Mequon. We're ready for our argument in the first case, Van Dyce Supply versus Shelby County State Bank. Mr. Barish.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Barry Barash. I'm from Galesburg, and I represent Van Dyce Supply Company, the appellant. With me is Jamie Ross, my partner, and adverse counsel is Jan Powell from Peoria. I would like to waive my rebuttal time and take my entire 15 minutes at this time. This is the third time that an aspect of the Hennings operation has been before this court. The first time was Van Dyce versus Shelby County State Bank, and we called that case the $3 million comma case. That was a case that Mr. Ross argued a year or so ago. The second time the case was here was a case in which we were not involved. That was the denial of Larry and Marissa Hennings' bankruptcy discharge under Section 727. And in that case, essentially, Judge Lesson in Springfield found that Larry and Marissa Hennings were crooks, and this court affirmed. Now we're here involved with about $1 million out of approximately $5.1 million, which the bank received from Hennings. I need to develop the facts a little bit because the fact pattern is a little hard to understand, and I'd like to, and it's fact intensive, if you'll bear with me on this. A number of suppliers sold goods to Hennings. Hennings sold farm products to farmers in a big way. Some of the sellers were Van Dyce Supply over in Iowa, Ciba Geigy, Monsanto, UAP Richter, and they sold in millions of dollars. We're not talking about small amounts. We're not talking about three or four bags of fertilizer. We're talking about millions of dollars worth of stuff. Van Dyce was first in time with a perfected security interest back in 1983. It retained a security interest in the goods, but as the goods were sold, goods became accounts, and Van Dyce's security interest then attached to the accounts. Under Illinois law, UCC 9-205, Van Dyce was not required to police its accounts. And the there are two cases that we've cited. One is the Seventh Circuit case, Brown and Williamson. Another is Funk, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case from 1982. So that the goods that Van Dyce sold ended up in a commingled mass at Hennings. Let's just imagine, as we say in the brief, a big pile of coal. Well, it's a big mass of farm chemicals of one kind or another. And Van Dyce's security interest continued in that entire undifferentiated mass. And I use the word undifferentiated or commingled in the sense of the Uniform Commercial Code. Van Dyce's security interest continued on the same basis as its interest in the commingled mass of goods. And that's the Ninth Circuit case of San Juan Packers and the Hallmar 3 case, a bankruptcy case from Massachusetts in 99, which gives a methodology for figuring out what Van Dyce's share of that undifferentiated mass is. Now, Shelby County State Bank is a smallish bank in eastern Illinois. And it got involved in a thing called the Business Manager Program, which is a factoring program. My understanding is that there were about 1,500 of these business manager programs that were sold to banks all over the country. And Hennings was Shelby County's first adventure into the factoring business with this business manager program. The bank was not familiar with business manager program, and the way it worked was Hennings would sell goods to a farmer. Farmer would, an account would be generated. Hennings would then cash the account or sell the account to Shelby County. Farmer would pay Shelby County. And that was the way the factoring program worked. As the accounts were collected, Shelby County received checks from the farmers, thereby satisfying the outstanding receivables. Now, the evidence is unmistakable that Shelby County did not do a UCC search before it entered into this program. It knew, as a matter of fact, that there were two prior security interests. One was Van Deest and the other was Monsanto's. By the way, Van Deest bought Monsanto's position, so for the purposes of this, it's all Van Deest. And Shelby County's UCC was filed in July of 93. Ours was filed 10 years earlier. We say that the bank converted our accounts when the bank received checks from farmers and cashed them, knowing that they were the proceeds of our collateral or somebody's collateral, and that wasn't the bank's collateral. And the bank overall collected $5.1 million, which it applied to Henning's debt. The source of the payments is clearly identified because what the bank did in this business manager program is a software program. And I don't think the bank knew we could do it, but what we did was we got a copy of the business manager program. And we went to the bank and we got all of their stuff. We got every piece of data they had. And we summarized it. It's 3,300 pages of data in this CD-ROM, which was submitted to the district court, along with the affidavit of our management information guy, Doug Main. Each payment which the bank received was identified by invoice, the farmer's name, the goods which made up the invoice, and the amount of the invoice. All of these records were maintained by the bank. None were maintained by Hennings. We didn't care about Hennings. They were all contained within the business manager program. And
how do you demonstrate that a check, just take one check, is for only something that was supplied by them?
It's all in the data. As the checks came in, they applied them. And it's all in the underlying data. The bank got the records, and we have copies. It's there.
So if somebody bought 1,000 pounds of seed or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Your records show that 3,000 pages full of records would show that is traceable to something that was delivered, the product that was delivered by Van Deest as opposed to somebody else.
No. What it will do is it will show that the farmer paid an invoice.
Right.
And it will show what the invoice will show what the goods were.
Right.
Now, whether Van Deest supplied those goods or whether Van Deest did not supply those goods is immaterial because we're dealing with an undifferentiated commingled mass. And under section 9315 of the code, we talk about a percentage. And that's what this Palmar 3 methodology is all about. We supplied 19% of the undifferentiated mass. And since the bank got $5.1 million, $969,000 of the money the bank got is Van Deest money.
That's where the rubber hits the road in this
exactly.
case. They claim that methodology is inappropriate.
Well, but they don't offer an alternative one, and as the court is well aware, if you have a methodology that works and that is sanctioned and is not junk science in violation of Kumho Tyre and Daubert, it ought to be all right.
But the district court considered that very question.
I don't think the district court did. I don't think the district court looked at this. There's a clear issue of fact down there. There was never a trial on this. They had a paper trial. And the court, this court has held very clearly.
But the district court looked at this evidence you presented.
I don't know. I don't know whether the district court did or not. But I know that there is a question. There's a sharp question of fact as to that the district court could not resolve without having a trial. And
is there additional evidence you would present? if this were remanded and went back to the district court to further consider this?
I think there probably would be, Judge Williams, I'm not sure what that evidence would be, because what the district court did was asked us to take a preliminary shot at this, which we did.
Right.
And that's where we came up with the 3,300 pages, came up with a methodology, came up with a percentage. We stopped there because we knew that we had further facts to develop. I think that all we need to do at this point is to show that we contributed inventory to the mass, and that the commingled mass was sold, that accounts were generated, the accounts were collected, and that the checks found their way to the bank. Now, the source, we can identify the checks. The source of the checks collected by the bank are clearly derived from the sale of the commingled mass. And so identification of Van Deese's collateral, to that extent, is complete. Van Deese accounts came into being as Henning sold goods to farmers from the commingled mass. And if you think about this, if you back up a little bit and think about this in bankruptcy code terms, it's almost like it's a Section 551 case, that the trustee in bankruptcy avoids a preference or avoids a fraudulent conveyance. The money comes into the bankruptcy estate. The money is there for the benefit of the entire creditor mass and not just for little pieces of it. It's not, you don't spread it out. It's a Moore versus Bay type analysis. Back in 1931. Now, the bank contends that in order for Van Deese to win, we must identify with particularity, I have to read this, the specific goods we sold to Hennings and to compute its aliquot share of the commingled mass forming each account. This is error as a matter of law. That's the San Juan Packers case and Uniform Commercial Code Section 9-315. The bank says that we have to prove that each accretion we made to the pile is a condition preceding to recovery. Now, suppose, for instance, that all of the people who sold goods to Hennings were plaintiffs in this case. That argument wouldn't work for the bank, then, would it? Because if all the people were plaintiffs, if all the suppliers were plaintiffs, then the bank, then it would just be the suppliers on one hand, and the bank on the other. And in this case, we don't have all the suppliers. Some were unsecured, some didn't pursue it, we did. And so that's where Section 9-315 comes in, and it's just crystal clear that we're entitled to prove our aliquot share of the undifferentiated commingled mass. The district court, as I mentioned a moment ago, requested preliminary computations. Although we say that we didn't have to do it, we did it. And we will have, if you find in our favor and you send this back and you say we're entitled to 19% or whatever our math turns out to be, then we'll get about $1 million and we will have lost about $2 million overall. There are disputes about the reliability of Henning's records, but there are no disputes, factual disputes, about the reliability of the banks. Finally, this court in a case called Waldridge back in 1994 said that a paper trial is not something which a trial court should conduct. And I quote, "Because summary judgment is not a paper trial, the district court's role in deciding the motion is not to sift through the evidence, pondering the nuances and inconsistencies, and decide whom to believe. The court has one task and one task only, to decide, based on the evidence of record, whether there is any material dispute of fact that requires a trial." One last point, and that has to do with the holder in due course issue. Shelby is not a holder in due course for two reasons. First, a receivables factor is held to a standard of notice. As a receivables factor, it's held to be on notice of the senior claims, which would be revealed on the UCC search. That's the case of Joe Morgan, the 11th Circuit case of 93, and an Iowa Supreme Court case called Arcanum, 1982. Secondly, the Arcanum case says that if the bank had notice of any claim, its status as putative holder in due course is destroyed. The bank not only had notice of claim, it admitted that it knew that there was a senior interest, didn't do the UCC search because it thought it was the holder in due course. It made a legal judgment which was wrong,
Let me go back to the material dispute. What is your sort of strongest case? Make your case for me in the next minute or so as to what the material dispute is.
Well, the material dispute is that the court below should have said, based on the preliminary stuff we gave them, that we had 19% of the aliquot pile. The bank got $5.1 million, and if you do the math, we were entitled to $969,000. The court below said that we had to prove what we actually put in into the undifferentiated pile, and that is a mistake as a matter of law.
So it's a question of methodology. I mean, in terms of the material dispute, you're saying that the documents that the bank generated, there's no question that these documents exist and what the documents reflect. It boils down to the methodology that the district court used. And that methodology was based on how the court perceived the law.
I agree.
Okay. If the Henning records are not entirely accurate, how does that affect the bottom line?
The bank thought that, Your Honor, the bank thought that Henning's needed to be able to show, or we needed to be able to show Henning's opening inventory. There was no way that anybody could show an opening inventory in this case. They didn't take inventories very frequently, and those were pretty rough. There's a closing inventory, but there certainly is no opening inventory that anybody can put their feet against. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Palmer.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Dan Powell. I'm from Peoria, and as Mr. Barash told you, I'm here today representing Shelby County State Bank. It's with a little bit of chagrin that I begin today's oral arguments by mentioning some errors in the brief, and unfortunately, to my great embarrassment, one was mine. I'd like to direct the court's attention to page 6 of the brief, where we had commented that a certain shipment was not directly to Van Diest. That was imprecise. As a matter of fact, the shipment first went to Van Diest. It was contemporaneously shipped to Snyder. It never became part of the math that's an issue here today. Nonetheless, Mr. Main included it within his documentation as forming part of the math. While my statement in the brief was imprecise, the conclusion that it was intended to reach does not differ by the fact that I failed to mention that it was contemporaneously shipped by Van Diest, then to Snyder Security. The other error in the brief, I believe, is an error by Mr. Barash on his reply brief. For some reason, he raises in this matter section 9330, something that you will note if you take a look at our brief, we never once raised. The only time we ever raised section 9330 in this matter was below, as a part of a separate and different defense not related to the holder in due course.
That's a little hard to follow this.
Okay.
Why don't you send us a letter?
That's fine. I'd be happy to do that.
Clarifying where you want to make a change in the brief.
All right, that's fine. Essentially, we are here today predominantly because of two aspects of the motion summary judgment below. As you'll note in the court's order, she did not get to all the other grounds Shelby raised for why we are not liable. In fact, she only got to the tracing ground, and on appeal, we basically have in the opening brief only one other mention, and that was the holder in due course issue, which we question whether the court would have jurisdiction at this time to actually rule on that matter in terms of ruling in favor of Van Diest, although you could uphold the district court on that issue in our favor without getting to the jurisdictional issue. However, let us turn to the tracing aspects and let's clarify a few of the facts that were presented to the court today. Much was made that this was a factoring arrangement. That term is used rather imprecisely by people in the industry. A true factoring arrangement is a buying of an account in which I no longer have recourse to the seller for the fact that it gets paid or doesn't get paid for the creditworthiness of the account. That was never what happened here, and the undisputed facts are clear that this was nothing more than a borrowing-based secured financing. In short, I lent you money. You're fully liable for it, but the amount I'm going to lend you is based on what your receivables are. In fact, there's very little difference in what was going on as of May of 1998 for what was going on the 5 years before, when basically they were doing revolving loans that were secured solely by accounts and inventory since 1993. So this is not a new situation contrary to what was represented. The other fact question that I wanted to discuss a little bit was this notion that we know that they had 19%.
Well, you acknowledge that Van Deese has an interest in at least some of the proceeds, right?
Yes, but if you'd like to look at the Homer case, they can't prove conversion without knowing the precise percentage. He's simply wrong in his presentation of Homer because there's two things that came up in that particular decision in the bankruptcy court. The first was the court specifically ruled as to a whole bunch of light bulbs, because they couldn't prove their exact percentage by virtue of the inventory method that they used was so unreliable, they found no conversion. The court then went to the wiring devices for which they had a starting balance and knew all shipments and could tell you precisely what the percentage was on each day afterwards that an account was created. Homer does not dispute our position. Neither does San Juan Packers. If you take a look at San Juan Packers, it was remanded to the district court because of an error made below.
So it's your position that even though Van Deese has an interest in some of the proceeds, they shouldn't recover any because they can't use the methodology that those cases say is correct.
That's correct.
Didn't the jury determine the amount of proceeds to which Van Deese is entitled?
I would agree if there was a method by which they could do it, but they have, by undisputed facts, have admitted they cannot do it. Both San Juan Packers and Homer requires them to demonstrate every day an account is made what the percentage is on that day the account is made. San Juan's very clear about this. There is a floating percentage that's going to differ based upon new shipments coming in, old shipments going out, sales being made. So if you can't say as to a particular account and a particular check what that percentage is, the Funk case is rather clear. We're not putting the burden on the general financer to risk having to give up some of its collateral because the person who took less than all the inventory and is not providing general financing can't tell you exactly what that amount is for that particular account. And they will never be able to do so. As admitted today, they do not know and will never know the starting inventory. And moreover, there is no undisputed fact that the inventory records of Hennings is completely unreliable. You have to remember that the bank statements only identify a product. That's all the bank records say. They do not identify whether it's Van Deese product or Monsanto's product or anything. They identify a product. Now, Van Deese says, well, we ship that kind of product. But that doesn't tell you how much they ship vis-a-vis other suppliers. And we know that Hennings lost over $2.5 million of its own inventory. In other words, its inventory records are garbage in, garbage out, which means anything that you would produce based on those records is going to be the same garbage. So the problem that you're going to get to, and which the district court found, is they can never do it.
Is there some minimum figure that a jury could settle on?
I don't know how that would be done. I mean,
I don't know either.
I really don't know how it would be done.
You concede that some, obviously, some of this material was sold on any given day was Van Deese's material.
To be honest with you, Your Honor, I simply do not know how you could possibly do it.
Well, they were a major supplier.
That's correct. So it's another
of the inventory that was sold.
Yeah, that's quite true. But as pointed out, there were a lot of other major inventory suppliers.
Well, do you agree that proportionate analysis is an appropriate method of tracing if the data on which to base the analysis is accurate?
Yes, I do. We're not. In fact, we would not have rested this case entirely on trying to dispute that. We believe we have other defenses, both that they haven't proven conversion under Illinois law and that we're a holder in due course. But in this particular case, we don't believe we need to even get to those issues because they simply cannot do it.
So your position is they just have no recourse?
That's correct.
And that conclusion would apply to any of the other suppliers as well?
I wouldn't apply to Monsanto because Monsanto had all inventory and wouldn't have had to do the tracing. Of course, Monsanto, contrary to Van Deese's claim here, cannot be merged into Van Deese's claim because Monsanto was paid in full.
And they're
not here, and they never could be here to raise any issue that we did any conversion with respect to their claim. They were paid in full.
And with respect to the other suppliers like Monsanto, did they have better records than Hennings?
Well, Monsanto wouldn't have been concerned about it because it was first in all inventory, not simply inventory it sold.
Right. But I'm just saying all the other suppliers, is there a way to get at it in a reverse way, look at the records of all the other suppliers, determine how much
inventory that they sold.
Right.
I think that would be possible, but I guess one has to get to a certain element of fairness here. One needs to take a look at the record. When we brought this up on summary judgment...
Well, I'm just saying, can it be proven the other way? If you can't prove it, if they don't have good records, or the other companies have good records...
I don't think that's been investigated. We brought them a summary judgment motion, pointed out that was their obligation to demonstrate this, and that they responded we needed more time. We pointed out that's a violation of Rule 56. You need to bring an affidavit demonstrating you can do this. They chose not to do that until they were ordered by the court below to do that. At some point in time, somebody who is defending on summary judgment, I believe, has the obligation to bring up the facts that demonstrate a dispute. If it could have been done, they've had 3 years to do so, and moreover, we're even warned by being ordered by the court to do so and file a Rule 56 affidavit.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that you were the one that had the burden, but I mean, that's another way to get at it.
It's possible. I think at this time, with discovery closed and the multitude of opportunities that's been done to have it, there's a time to close this case, and I think this is now that time. The records that they have relied on and which they have achieved in discovery simply cannot do it. I can tell you that much. But it does raise a more interesting argument, how he can possibly be denied holder in due course status. He admits in the affidavits that were supplied below that to do even this 19% rule, which is not a proper methodology, more than 100 hours worth of work went in to come into this. There is no way anyone taking a check on any particular account could be aware that Van Diest had any interest in that particular check. Now, he likes to point out that, well, that doesn't matter because you knew Monsanto had an interest. Well, that's a misunderstanding of Holder in due course. It's a misunderstanding because it is quite proper for junior account lenders to actually collect accounts and collect payments. Unless they have a reason to believe they're doing so in violation of an agreement, it is not considered notice of a claim to the check. It's done all the time. And it's been upheld time and time again in case law. Now, what happens in this particular instance is that Monsanto got paid in full. We never could have possibly converted any claim of Monsanto's with respect to what we took in that account. They were being paid in full. I think it's a little, they have a hard time saying, well, wait a minute, you want to raise holder in due course status, you now have to prove, as to the world, nobody else had a claim. I think that they're going to have to demonstrate that if their claim is no good, well, we are all of a sudden going to be held up from holder in due course status because they're hypothesized the possibility that somebody else is raising a claim who, in fact, is not raising a claim. They got paid in full. So I don't know how anyone can suggest that when Shelby took any check, it would possibly have notice of Van Diest's interest, because even today we can't possibly know what interest was in any check, and by their own admission, we'll never know. This notion that 9315 means that all I got to do is add up everything I've shipped and compare it to everything everybody else shipped, and that gives me the parata, is simply wrong. It was rejected in San Juan. Basically, your day-to-day parata share of inventory changes based on the shipments that are sent. And for them, this notion that they can just take 19% of everything Shelby received, because they can show they basically shipped 19% of everything since the particular time period, is just not correct. As I pointed out in an example in the brief, this would mean that if I ship 100 widgets today and Van Diest ships 100 widgets a month from now, that if I sell any account between now and a month from now, they're still going to claim 50%. And they know they don't have any interest, because they didn't bother to check the starting balance, that there was already 100 widgets there. I think it's quite clear that you can't do it in that particular way. And the records will never give you an answer. So the only thing you would have to do is go back to the very policy decision that was discussed in Funk. Do you basically put the risk that they might claim too much collateral on the general financer who provided all the cash flows that essentially allowed Hannings to pay for every single piece of inventory that could have possibly go into those accounts to Van Diest? Because that is a fact that wasn't stressed by Mr. Barash this morning. The last account that Hannings factored was in December of 1998. It represents inventory from farmers who basically could have only bought product that had been shipped before October of that year. And yet Hannings received payment in full for all of that inventory. The only inventory it did not receive payment for, and for which it's here in this court, is inventory that was sent after November. Essentially, there isn't any way one can argue from an equitable point of view that Van Deest has been harmed by what the bank did. The bank provided general financing that allowed suppliers such as Van Deest to be paid on an ongoing basis. And there is no equitable reason to feel sorry for them in this particular situation. They continued to ship goods after the pending started to go into trouble. And while it's true the code doesn't require them to police, that provision of 205 was in there for one reason only, and that was prior case law that said the minute you didn't police, you automatically lost your security interest. But it doesn't mean that if you don't police, there isn't any risk to you. The code is full of times where if you don't police your collateral, there's going to be risk to you, including the fact that cash proceeds can get dispersed, as well as checks be written on accounts that can go to holder in due course. So I just believe that essentially this is a legal question, and then the question is whether the methodology was appropriate. And the law says the methodology was not appropriate. San Juan Packers is clear that it's not appropriate. Hamels is clear that it is not appropriate. Therefore, I see no reason for this to go back to the court below, because as conceded finally by Mr. Barash, the court's decision below was based on the issue of law, not an issue of fact. There is no disputed fact in this case.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.